I love drawing the connection between a certain picture of what kinds of beings we are and what the universe fundamentally looks like, and then an ethical response to that. Given that, according to some Buddhists, the universe is nothing but a bunch of collections of ever-changing, momentary occurrences.
Keating, and you're listening to Sutras and Stuff. Today on the podcast, how does encountering Indian philosophy make a difference in our thinking about what exists and how we can talk about it? This episode is the seventh in a series of conversations with philosophers who've taught Indian philosophy at Yale and US College in Singapore, an unusual liberal arts college where students first encounter philosophy through a global two-semester sequence, which includes not just Indian philosophy, but Chinese philosophy, Islamic philosophy, ancient Greek and Roman philosophy, and works from European traditions. Because this academic experiment is ending in 2025, I wanted to hear from professors who came to learn about Indian philosophy by teaching it in this global context. Most of them were experts in other areas of philosophy first. So I wanted to know, what did they learn from this experiment? Did it change their understanding of themselves, of philosophy, of the world?
My name is Neil Mehta, and I am an associate professor of philosophy at Yale and US College. I work mostly on philosophy of mind, including questions about consciousness and perception.
He's published many articles on questions like, what kinds of awareness are there in consciousness? And what is the relationship between our experience of the world and the world itself? You'll also discover, if you visit his website, that Neil's an enthusiast of role-playing games and improv comedy. In our conversation, he shared some other biographical details that explain his connections to Indian philosophy.
I am Indian, ethnically speaking. And as such, I grew up with a certain passing knowledge of various Indian religions, including Jainism, which is the religion of my parents, although not my religion. And that involved some knowledge of philosophical matters. Jainism involves a very particular ethical worldview, a theory of reincarnation, things like that. But I wouldn't say that that was a really deep and properly philosophical way of engaging with those ideas.
Unfortunately, we haven't talked about Jainism yet on the podcast. Jains are often known for their moral commitment to what's called ahimsa, or nonviolence. And this leads them to religious practices, including some very disciplined vegetarianism. And while Jainism includes a commitment to reincarnation, as Neil mentions, a commitment pretty broadly shared across Indian traditions, it's also sometimes called atheistic, since Jain philosophers reject the idea of an all-powerful creator god. In this way, they're not unlike Buddhists, who come into existence as a movement around the same time, about the 6th century BCE. But it was Buddhist texts which caught Neil's attention during his time at Yale and US.
The first time that I really got to engage with Indian philosophy as philosophy was when I joined Yale and US back in 2012. We read things like the Questions of King Milinda, which is an early Buddhist text, and we read Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika, which is the fundamental wisdom of the middle way on some translations. And that is an extremely advanced, very sophisticated philosophical text that I had a lot of fun trying to wrap my head around. There are a lot of really fascinating connections that I see between classical Buddhist philosophy and contemporary philosophy that I do. One of those links is in philosophy of language. A really interesting idea that you find in Buddhist texts is a distinction between conventional and ultimate truth. And that distinction is very important in Buddhist philosophy, but it took me quite a while to realize that it meant different things to different philosophers. One thing that it means to some Indian Buddhist philosophers, I think, though, is that there's a distinction between what is really strictly speaking true and what is useful to say.
I'll put a link in the show notes to an encyclopedia entry which surveys some of the main approaches to this idea in Indian Buddhism.
To give a very contemporary example, I tell my students in all my classes that I start class promptly on time. And I even have an alarm that goes off at the exact moment, allegedly, when class is supposed to start. So I might say, this class starts at 4 p.m. But when you think about it, you realize that in the strictest sense, that statement has got to be false. No class of mine has ever started at 4 p.m. down to the trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. But we don't worry about that. It is much more convenient to just say the class starts at 4 p.m. sharp and leave it at that. Something similar is true, according to some Buddhist philosophers, when they talk about conventional truth. The idea is that on this understanding, something is conventionally true when it is convenient to say and close enough to the actual truth for present purposes. One important idea in Buddhist philosophy is that the claim that there is a self is at best a conventional truth. We can talk about selves because it's convenient to act as though there is some persisting locus of consciousness and identity over time. But according to these Buddhist theorists, that's not ultimately true. Strictly speaking, there's no such thing.
While it doesn't explicitly use the framework of the two truths, the Questions of King Milinda is one place where we can see roughly the kind of distinction Neil is talking about. In that text, a Buddhist monk says that the name Nagasena is a useful designation. It's a word that we use to keep track of an aggregate of constantly changing stuff that is born and lives and dies. Now, that aggregate is made up of smaller parts, like matter and mental experiences. Nagasena isn't his spleen or his consciousness, nor is he a combination of all of these parts together. Neither is he something else. We talked about this in our episode with Andrew Bailey. Now, whatever the details, and there are lots of philosophical views about these details, the Buddhists think we are confused about what really exists.
According to some of these Buddhists, as I best understand them, most of our ordinary discourse is only conventionally true. We talk about ordinary things like desks, chairs, computers, and in the strictest understanding, none of those things really exist. In the same way that in the strictest understanding, very few containers that we have are ever empty. They always have air or a few drops of water or something, but it's convenient to talk about those things. I think that this idea has really interesting applications in contemporary metaphysics. I think there are a lot of contemporary metaphysicians who hold quite similar views to these ancient Buddhist philosophers and who also think that, strictly speaking, there are no tables, there are no chairs, but it is very convenient to talk as if there were such things.
Let's go back to Nagasena. The aggregate, composed of momentary bits of matter and experiences, changes over time. Not only does it lose skin cells and so on, but the experience changes, depending on thoughts, feelings, and perceptions. In this way, what we call Nagasena doesn't exist ultimately. Only the simplest, most fundamental parts ultimately exist. But it's useful to talk about Nagasena. You might wonder how it would be useful to talk about Nagasena if Nagasena doesn't ultimately exist. Well, one reason could be that ethical practices, which reduce and remove suffering, are a little bit easier to appreciate if we track persons. Even though there's no self that ultimately really exists, the fundamental bits that do exist have very complicated causal relationships, and we can track these approximately by talking about people. So names and other words are convenient labels for what, ultimately speaking, doesn't really exist. And this idea is related to another one that Neil also finds interesting.
There is a huge discussion in contemporary philosophy about something called grounding. And you can think of grounding as a metaphysical kind of explanation. As a contrast, there's causal explanation. I kick the ball. That causes the ball to go flying through the air. My kicking and the ball flying, the cause and the effect, happen at different times. And that's part of what makes it a causal relationship. This other kind of explanation that I'm talking about, grounding, often does not happen across times like that. It happens at a single time. We might say, for example, that because there are atoms arranged in a particular way, there is a chair here. Those two facts, the atoms being arranged in a certain way and the chair being here, are not facts happening at different times. They're at the same time. And some philosophers theorize that there is an explanatory relationship of grounding between those two facts. They say that the fact that the atoms are there is what grounds the fact that the chair is there. Ordinarily, we think that causation has to go in a straight line, aside from weird time travel stories, Avengers Endgame notwithstanding. We think that causation doesn't go in circles. And people in Western philosophy typically think the same thing about grounding. According to Priest's interpretation of Nagarjuna,
that's Graham Priest, an Australian philosopher, now at CUNY in New York.
Grounding does sometimes go in circles. And grounding sometimes goes in very complicated webs that circle back. That idea, I think, is a really interesting idea that deserves serious metaphysical investigation. And it is quite different from any of the dominant theories of grounding that I find in contemporary philosophy, although it is starting to get interest paid to it because of the work of people like Priest and a lot of other philosophers.
We can relate grounding to the two truths doctrine. One way to think about grounding is that the existence of certain things grounds the truth of sentences about those things. So the existence of a bunch of individual grains of sand grounds the truth of the sentence, "There is a heap of sand." In the same way, for a Buddhist like Nagasena, the existence of fundamental bits of reality could ground the truth of the sentence, "Nagasena exists." These fundamental bits are called dharmas, by the way. Okay, but what about Nagarjuna and circular grounding? Well, in the few minutes we have left, there's no way I can summarize that controversy, but I will leave some links in the show notes. Suffice it to say that Nagarjuna's ideas are extremely challenging to interpret. In fact, he warns that one of his main metaphysical concepts is like a snake, which, if you don't grasp it in just the right way, will bite you. But he and other Buddhists think that if you grasp their ideas correctly, you will avoid pain and suffering. And this is something that Neil has also thought a lot about.
There is one very important practical thing that I would like to share about Indian philosophy, and a very personal thing. I have fibromyalgia, which is a condition where someone experiences a lot of pain in their body, but there's nothing physically wrong. It's just that the nerves are sending bad signals to the brain. It turns out that one of the cutting-edge treatments for this is mindfulness meditation, which is a practice honed in many places around the world, but certainly ancient Buddhists were among the most important founders and disseminators of this style of meditation. And along with that, there is a certain very large and complex ethical worldview. Part of this worldview is to be able to accept the sensations and feelings in your body for what they are, without judgment, which I have found enormously helpful on a practical level in living my life. I can say that my fibromyalgia symptoms are greatly reduced because of this mindfulness meditation. And another aspect of these meditative practices is loving kindness or compassion-based meditation. That has fundamentally changed my relationship with the people around me. I am a better teacher, a better colleague, a better friend, a better partner because of these ethical insights that really do stem from Buddhist texts, among other places. So I would say that Indian philosophy has a personal significance to me in addition to the fascinating theoretical significance that I find it to have.
Yeah, and if I can follow up on that, this is something that I think sometimes gets divorced from the earlier comments that you've made about the metaphysics, the epistemology, the philosophy of language. But I think this is one thing which, at least speaking for myself and others that I know, it draws people into Indian philosophy, that you have both together and they're not just two tracks, but they're in fact interrelated, right? Does that in any way impact your thinking about what you're doing in metaphysics and epistemology in your professional life?
Really fascinating question. The answer has got to be yes, because there are throughout philosophy so many weird and complicated and tangled relationships between your metaphysics, your theory of what there is, your epistemology, your theory of how we know things, your ethics, your theory of what to do, and all sorts of other branches of philosophy. And I doubt that I can fully articulate what some of those connections are, but I will say that when I lecture on Buddhist philosophy, I love drawing the connection between a certain picture of what kinds of beings we are and what the universe fundamentally looks like, and then an ethical response to that. given that, according to some Buddhists, the universe is nothing but a bunch of collections of ever-changing momentary occurrences, given there is no permanence to anything, what sort of ethical attitude can we productively adopt to engage with the world? And there is a complex argumentative line here that I won't try to trace now, but I will just say that that is really fascinating. And I'll add that there are also people in Western philosophy who are using any kind of metaphysics, Western or otherwise, to engage productively with ethical questions. For example, questions about the social construction of gender, race, and so on. There are people who have tried to conceptualize that using metaphysical tools like grounding, which I discussed earlier. So I think that we should all agree that there are going to be these complex and subtle connections between different fields of philosophy, and those are well worth exploring. Ancient Indian philosophers did very well, so we should read what they said.
Well, thanks for your time, Neil. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Malcolm, and for putting together this really helpful project.